Thanks. Right, well, I mean, we're all aware, I think, of why we're having this meeting, because suddenly, you know, the name of Trotsky has been bandied around in the media in relation to, apparently, we're all flooding into the Labour Party. If only there were 130 or 180,000 of us to flood into the Labour Party, that would be a big step forward for the revolutionary movement in this country. Well, that's another argument, I suppose, about whether we should be in the Labour Party or not. But the idea that there are Trotskyists in the Labour Party ought not to be news to anybody, because there is and there have been for a long time. But there are also organisations like ours, which are part of that Trotskyist tradition, which remain outside the Labour Party and, you know, remain as an independent revolutionary current. I mean, some of the stuff, I try to keep up with it on Facebook and the news and so on. It is quite laughable. I mean, there was one yesterday where the Telegraph had this really old piece of news, actually. It dragged out that apparently Jeremy Corbyn had at one time signed an early day motion in Parliament calling for the reinstatement of Trotsky. It wasn't actually his motion, but he put his name to it. And they dragged this up as kind of evidence yet again that the Labour Party is tainted by these Trotskyist infiltrators. And I think what I'm going to try and do today, I mean, doing a meeting on Trotsky is really difficult in many ways, I've discovered, having sort of looked at some of my Trotsky stuff again, because there is so much that you could pick up on, each of which, and each issue of which, would be worthy of a meeting in itself, to be perfectly honest. But what I'll try and do is just pick up on Trotsky's significance, really, and talk a little bit about his life, if people didn't know that, and then really what you know, what is our tradition about, because it is rooted very much, I think, in what Trotsky wrote and did in his quite long political life. I first came across Trotsky's writings when I was at university a long time ago. I read his autobiography, actually, My Life, which is, if you haven't read it, it's a great book to read. I read it before I was kind of politically involved. I was a new young student, and I read it almost as a kind of an autobiography, you know, a nice story. It was about the Russian Revolution. I didn't really kind of click on the significance of it until somewhat later. My first experience of being accused of being a Trotskyist was when I was, a few years later, I had just actually joined the party, and I was the secretary of Guildford Trades Council down south, which is where you probably detect that I come from. And I made I moved a motion calling for support for an anti-fascist protest. I think it was the one at Lewisham, actually. I was calling support for that. And I made this speech, and I thought it would be a kind of a no-brainer that everybody would support this. It's so kind of obvious. Here's the National Front planning to march and so on. And I made this speech. And this grizzled old guy, who I turned out was in the Communist Party, sort of lumbered to his feet and said, "Well, we've heard from the Trotsky fascist. Now let's make a informed decision," and probably argued why we shouldn't mobilise against the fascists. And I remember sitting and turning to somebody next to me and saying, "Was it me, Trotsky fascist?" And I'm kind of looking around and saying, "Who else has spoken? It's only me, you know." And I had, you know, it was my first experience of Stalinist anti-Trotskyism, really, I suppose. So I want to go through various things, really. This is a bit daunting, but actually I've just brought these along for instruction more than anything. There are a couple of things I want to read. I actually want to start with a relatively short quote. This is from, I found this really old pamphlet of ours, a Trotsky pamphlet from 1970, believe it or not. It was, I think, 5p. Those are the days, weren't they? Pamphlets are 5p. But on the back is Trotsky's testament. And I think it's worth just reading this to set the scene a bit. I'm not going to read the whole thing because it's too long, but I'll just read the last couple of paragraphs where he says, well, the first paragraph as well is useful. He says, "My high and still rising blood pressure is deceiving those near me about my actual condition. I'm active and able to work, but the outcome is evidently near. these lines will be made public after my death. And this was written just a few months before he was in fact murdered. He says, for 43 years of my conscious life, I've remained a revolutionist. For 42 of them, I've fought under the banner of Marxism. If I had to begin all over again, I would, of course, try to avoid this or that mistake. But the main course of my life would remain unchanged. I shall die a proletarian revolutionist, a Marxist, a dialectical materialist, and consequently an irreconcilable atheist. My faith in the communist future of mankind is not less ardent, indeed it is firmer today than it was in the days of my youth. Natasha, that's his wife. Natasha has just come up to the window from the courtyard and opened it wider so that the air may enter more freely into my room. I can see the bright green strip of grass beneath the wall and the clear blue sky above the wall and sunlight everywhere. Life is beautiful. Let the future generations cleanse it of all evil, oppression and violence and enjoy it to the full. And that was written in February 1940. He was assassinated a few months later. And by this time, virtually his whole family had been murdered, exiled or committed suicide. In fact, the only member of his family actually to survive was his wife, Natasha, who survived him by about 20 years. There'd been several assassination attempts. I mean, around about this time, there was a machine gun attack on his house, where there were like 200 bullets embedded in the walls of his bedroom and in the walls of the house and so on. So, this was kind of how it ended. But we need to talk much more, obviously, about the legacy. The key thing that when you read this stuff and you read towards the end of his life and you're struck by a number of things, really. One of which is that he never ever deviated from the basic Marxist principles, which were the two key principles being that Marx is saying that the emancipation of the working class is the act of the working class itself. It has to be the working class and working class action and struggle that frees the working class. No other class and no other individuals can do that emancipation, can achieve that emancipation on behalf of the class. And the second one is the notion of proletarian or working class internationalism. Absolutely fundamentally the notion that you cannot build socialism in one country. That brought him into conflict with Stalin in particular in the mid-1920s. But it was, the working class is an international working class, and that the revolution, therefore, has to be an international revolution or it cannot survive. And, events, as we'll see a bit later, prove that to be the case. If you've not read much Trotsky, it's actually, most of it is not kind of intimidating. Most of it is really accessible. There's some really, really good stuff. I've used quite a lot of stuff from Duncan Hallis's little pamphlet, well, book really, on Trotsky's Marxism. But he wrote on an enormous range of subjects, which you can have a look at. I'll just point these out to you. There's the Lessons of October, which is a fantastically important book about the revolution. And then there's a whole series. I just picked out some of these pamphlets: Leon Trotsky Against Individual Terrorism, Leon Trotsky on Marxism in Our Time, Class and Art. There's a little one on the flight from Siberia, which I think was in the back of a. Under a pile of hay, basically, in the back of a cart. But there's more to it than that in there, of course. Trotsky on the Jewish question. Really relevant stuff in many ways. Trotsky on black nationalism and self-determination. Women and the family. There's even one here on, because this was a newfangled thing at the time, radio science, technique and society. Fascism. This is one of the, if you haven't read this, this is one of the key books, I think. Fascism, The Struggle Against Fascism in Germany. Absolutely brilliant piece of analysis and piece of writing, which people should read. And this, which is both a brilliantly written piece of history, but also a fantastic piece of political analysis as well, The History of the Russian Revolution. It's the classic, really. And there are biographies as well of Trotsky that you can read to kind of look at the where it all fits together. There's Tony Cliff's biography. There's a biography by Isaac Deutscher, three-volume biography as well. Which, is a bit politically dodgy in some places because Isaac Deutscher was, you know, was not really in the Trotskyist tradition, whereas of course we know Tony Cliff was very much so. So there's lots of stuff there. I'm going to very quickly kind of summarise the key events in Trotsky's life, but you'll appreciate since he was active for 40 odd years, there's a lot of key events. I'm assuming people don't know much about Trotsky. Okay, so that's where we're going with this. So he was born Lev Davidovich Bronstein, not Trotsky, to a fairly comfortable Jewish farming family in the Ukraine, 1879. Actually, Trotsky was the name of one of his jailers. He took that as a pseudonym when he was locked up in Siberia. He had to fill out. He had some false papers, and they weren't very well forged. he had to write a new name in, and he thought, "Oh, shall I write? Oh, yeah, that bastard Trotsky who locked me up. I love him." So it was Lev Davidovich Trotsky from then on. He joined an organisation called the Narodniks, which was a kind of peasant revolutionary organisation, when he was 17. So he started pretty young. But he moved on from that pretty quickly. He realised that, you know, the peasantry couldn't really be a revolutionary class for reasons that I'll come to a bit later on. A year after he joined them, he became a Marxist. He didn't have long to be a Marxist in freedom because he was arrested at the age of 19. He served 18 months in prison for, you know, sedition and doing naughty things that we take for granted actually these days, like leafleting and, you know, writing tracts and meeting and so on. Of course, that was all illegal at that time in Tsarist Russia. Spent 18 months in jail, then he was exiled to Siberia. He escaped in 1902 under the Hay. Arrived in London to join other emigre revolutionaries at the time, including Lenin. Lenin was very struck by him. Lenin wanted to get him on the editorial board of the revolution newspaper, which was blocked by, you know, one or two of the older comrades who didn't want him there. He played a very prominent role in the split. I don't know how much people know about this, but the Russian, they were called Social Democrats, but the Russian Social Democratic Party split in 1903 between what's called the Mensheviks, which is just Russian for minority, and the Bolsheviks, which is the Russian for majority. And Trotsky actually ended up siding with the Mensheviks, with Martov and the Mensheviks. And the reason was he disagreed with Lenin essentially on two issues, really. One was on what the nature of a future revolution would be in Russia, and secondly, on what the nature of the Revolutionary Party needed to be. Lenin was for a centralist, you know, quite a tight centralist professional party at that time. And Trotsky took a much more sort of an idea that you somehow there would be a more or less spontaneous uprising of workers. You didn't need a centralised political party. He did later come back and say that the break with Lenin on that issue was the biggest mistake of his life. And in the end, he went back on that position, which we'll kind of come to. Now, one of the key events then happened shortly after. 1905, the first Russian Revolution, the great dress rehearsal, took place. And you have to think about this. I mean, they all had to kind of rush back, you know, from exile. Trotsky comes rushing back. Age of 25, he gets himself elected to what's called the Soviet in Russia, but it was the Workers' Council of Petrograd. Petrograd was the key working class industrial area in Russia. And here's this 25-year-old who's been exiled. But, you know, because of his the trust people had in him, his oratorical skills, his organizational ability, and interestingly, even though he was Jewish, in a town and, you know, in a city that was notably anti-Semitic, you know, the working class, the most advanced sections of the working class, elected him as their president. People will know that revolution was not successful. It was crushed pretty quickly, really. And again, you know, people, the revolutionaries had to sort of flee all over the place to get out of it. Interestingly, though, just a year after that, Trotsky came up with one of the key theories, which has been sort of thrown around because people don't really understand it very often, but it's the theory of permanent revolution, which doesn't mean constantly making a revolution, but does mean it says something about the role of the working class in a society that is a majority peasantry. I'll come back to that if I've got time a bit later on. I don't know if I have got time.
10 minutes.
Oh, okay. I better hurry up and know. Okay. They then followed a whole period, more years of exile, basically. They all had to sort of sod off to Switzerland and London and everywhere else, that would take them. Otherwise, they'd have ended up dead or in jail. So skip ahead to February 1917 and the Russian Revolution, the first Russian Revolution, the first part of the Russian Revolution of that year. Lenin comes back in April and has a big fight, basically, with the leadership of the Bolshevik Party, who are kind of treading water, on the question of the revolution, and are supporting the provisional government, the government that's done away with the Tsar. The Tsar has been deposed and so on in the uprising. And Lenin comes back and he pushes something called the April Theses, which is basically his argument that we have to move beyond the provisional government. The provisional government has to be overthrown, and what we have to do is go for a workers' government. Now, actually, that position is effectively the same position as Trotsky has held for the last 12 years, and that Lenin has been arguing against Trotsky for all that time. But Lenin, the force of events, he thinks, actually, Trotsky's right on this. And Trotsky comes back, says, good old Lenin, he's adopted my approach on this. I have no forces. I have no real organisation. I can't do a thing in terms of moving the revolution forward here. And he decides that Lenin's been right all along on the question of the party, and that you need a revolutionary party to pull together the most advanced sections of the worker. And so he decides he's going to join the Bolshevik Party. Virtually no time at all, Trotsky is then thrown into organising. Literally, he organised the insurrection in October. It was Trotsky that organised that. And there's a fantastic bit of writing which I will get to you. People again are under the impression very often that the Russian Revolution itself was this sort of bloodbath, and it actually wasn't. Particularly in Petrograd, hardly anybody, if anybody at all, actually died. It was a smooth transition because it was clear that power had already moved to the workers and to the workers' organisations in the Soviet. Quite smoothly, and this is a bit of writing from, just a little section from the Russian Revolution. And he says, the bourgeois classes had expected barricades, flaming conflagrations, looting, rivers of blood. In reality, a silence reigned more terrible than all the thunders of the world. The social ground shifted noiselessly like a revolving stage, bringing forward the popular masses, carrying away to limbo the rulers of yesterday. Carry the bastards away to limbo, I say. Fantastic. And he, he organised that. He then had to face, or they, the Bolsheviks, then had to face the attempts by the white armies, by the counter-revolutionaries, by foreign armies to come in and put the revolution down. And Trotsky, was the person who formed the Red Army. He was the leader of the Red Army during a two-year civil war that fought back against those armies and ultimately triumphed. He was busy rushing about from one front to another in his armoured train and so on. An incredible achievement, really. He was also the person who had led the peace negotiations to pull Russia out of the First World War, which that millions of Russian workers had been put in uniforms and had died at the front. And there was the Brest-Litovsk peace deal, which was terrible for Russia, actually. They lost great swathes of Ukraine and other parts, industrial parts of Russia. But it was necessary to pull them out of the First World War and fulfil Lenin's slogan of peace, land, and bread. You had to first have peace, and that meant coming out of the war. Trotsky played a prominent role in what was called the Third Communist International. The Second International had been the one that collapsed in 1914 on the outbreak of war. It was only the Bolsheviks, and the Serbs and the Bulgarians and some individuals, you know, John McClane in this country, Connolly, you know, various others, individuals very often, who stood out against the war. But Trotsky did, along with Lenin, and they'd opposed that. But it had meant the collapse of that international. There was no international until, in the revolutionary period after the Russian Revolution, they set up the new one, the Third International. And in our tradition, the Trotskyist tradition, the first four congresses, the first four, you know, international meetings of that body are the ones that had to grapple with the most enormous issues, you know, dealing with kind of centrists, people who are partly revolutionaries or talk revolution but don't really want to follow it through, wanted to join the international because of the kudos that the Russian revolutionaries had. They all wanted to join this. And how do you keep out these people who are not actually revolutionaries? How do you stop your most keen ultra-left elements from, you know, from revolutionary adventures that actually end up damaging the process and the prospects of revolution, like it did in Germany in 1918, which actually led to the murder of Karl Liebknecht and Luxemburg, who were the kind of leaders of the left, because they went too soon. They didn't have the mass of the working class behind them. All those kind of issues were, you know, facing them at the time. After that, as people will know, I mean, people know Trotsky opposed Stalin. That was a process whereby Trotsky, I mean, Lenin was kind of out of things by this time, by 1922-23. He was ill, there'd been assassination attempts on him and so on, died in early 1924. So Trotsky was the one who was kind of left trying to hold the line, really, against the growing Stalinist bureaucracy. Which, you know, was moving against basic Marxist principles. The notion that Stalin came up with in 1924, which was the idea that you could have socialism in one country, you didn't have to have international revolution, you know, we could plow on and produce, you know, just build socialism in Russia, was completely against the whole idea of, you know, the international nature of the revolution and the international nature of the working class. You can't do it. It's absolutely central to our tradition that you cannot do that. It's not possible to do it. And Trotsky had to kind of argue against that, fight in the left opposition, as it was called, to try and reverse the tide that was clearly running that way. He was exiled in 1929 from Russia, spent the last 11 years of his life going from country to country, ended up in Mexico, and was left really trying to pull together little groups of people who agreed with his ideas against Stalin. And they were often tiny little groups, you know, a dozen people here, you know, 100 or so here. Only a couple of countries had significant, you know, like more than a few hundred or 1,000 or two supporters. All of his old comrades, you know, Lenin's and his old comrades, perished. In one way or another, they were executed, you know, jailed, false confessions were beaten out of them by the Stalinists, they were, you know, on pain of, you know, their families were killed, their whole families were you know, exiled and were murdered. He was finally murdered by an agent who kind of wormed his way into his household, a guy called Jackson. A Spanish Stalinist who killed him with, you know, the old proverbial ice axe. It was not an ice pick, it was actually an ice axe that he used to attack him, and he died a couple of weeks later. What was the significance? Well, again,
excuse
another
me,
short...
Sorry to interrupt you. I've been told the photography club meets here. Would anybody know where I'd find them?
They're not meeting till September.
Thank you. Thanks. Sorry to interrupt.
Okay. He sums up his own on the 25th of March, just a few years before he died, and he's writing in his diary. He says, had I not been present in 1917 in Petersburg, the October Revolution would still have taken place, on the condition that Lenin was present and in command. If neither Lenin nor I had been present in Petersburg, there would have been no October Revolution. the leadership of the Bolshevik Party would have prevented it from occurring. That's another story, but you know, people should read up on this. Of this I have not the slightest doubt. If Lenin had not been in Petersburg, I doubt whether I could have managed to conquer the resistance of the Bolshevik leaders. But I repeat, granted the presence of Lenin, the October Revolution would have been victorious anyway. Thus I cannot speak of the indispensability of my own work, even about the period from 1917 to 1921. But now, this is in 1935, but now my work is indispensable in the full sense of the word. There's no arrogance in this claim at all. The collapse of the two internationals has posed a problem which none of the leaders of these internationals is at all equipped to solve. The vicissitudes of my personal fate have confronted me with this problem and armed me with important experience in dealing with it. There is now no one except me to carry out the mission of arming a new generation with the revolutionary method over the heads of the leaders of the Second and Third International. I mean, very, very perceptive, incredibly perceptive, but absolutely tragic, isn't it? You know, here's somebody who has the analysis, has the ideas, has the experience, but has no forces to implement, to, you know, he has the end, he knows what the end should be, but no means to bring about that end. And that's the, you know, absolutely tragic situation. I haven't got time to go into any detail on the key things, but I will just kind of draw my remarks to a close on some of this stuff really. So what were Trotsky's key achievements? I think obviously there were the practical successes, you know, the leadership of the insurrection and so on, you know, the Red Army, all that stuff. Fantastic, absolutely, you know, world-class successes. But also there were the advances in Marxist theory, which dealt with things that, you know, no revolutionaries had to think about up to that time. So the things that we now see as part of our political landscape, which have been Stalinism, for example, the rise of Stalinism, how do you actually, other than saying, you know, it was terrible, how do we explain that, you know, in materialist terms, in class terms, in economic terms? How did it arise in the circumstances in Russia? You know, those things hadn't had to be dealt with before. The whole growth of reformism, you know, which hadn't really existed in Marx's day, but, you know, emerged and has become stronger and stronger, actually, over the years. And it's something that we now have to grapple with, particularly when you think about what's happening in the Labour Party. Because it's great, it is brilliant what's happening inside the Labour Party. But it's people, masses of people, moving into a reformist organisation, which is really not that reformist at all in many ways, you know, poses all sorts of opportunities. But actually, we have to think about how do we relate to that, you know, and there are clues, very big clues, and very big nudges in what Trotsky wrote. And of course, in fascism. Fascism hadn't existed in the world until the Italian fascism of the early 1920s, and then even more horribly the German, you know, Nazis taking power in 1933. And, you know, those things, rather than saying, aren't they awful, aren't they just extreme Tories, you know, they're not. Trotsky analysed the rise of fascism, and more importantly analysed how to resist it. So he was calling for a united front of working class parties, the Socialist Party, the Communist Party, in order to block and defeat the growth of the fascists. And unfortunately, as we know, history, you know, is clear, that didn't happen. And the Nazis came through the middle, smashed all workers' organisations. And Trotsky could see this happening. He could see it happening. He knew it would happen in Germany if there wasn't that unity. And that united front approach to how you build and how you work with people who don't agree with you. They're not revolutionaries, but they, you know, they will work with you on certain issues. And how do you work with people like that and not be sectarian, you know, not adopt a sectarian approach, which the Communist Party in Germany did in the early 1930s. Absolutely disastrous outcome. He wasn't always right. He was mistaken in certain things. He made errors and mistakes, you know, freely admitted them, actually, generally speaking. But also, you know, there was fantastic groundbreaking analyses. And just, I'll just list four because I've got no more time to do that. But The Theory of Permanent Revolution, fantastically important advance on, in terms of theory. I've talked about the analysis of Stalinism, anti-fascism, so on, but also what he had to say about the relationship between the, you know, a revolutionary party, a socialist revolutionary party, and the class, you know, the working class in general. What form should that party take? Should it be centralist or not? Should it, you know, whatever? All sorts of issues which were worked out in practice in the building of the Bolshevik Party, and which Trotsky tried to build on in trying to keep together to build another international, you know, communist international, to build more revolutionary parties in country after country. You know, unfortunately, relatively unsuccessfully. So I'm not going to talk. I was going to talk more about some of those, but I can't. So just to end up, really, what's the legacy? Well, I mean, Trotsky is. We know. We've just seen the last few weeks. I mean, you know, Trotsky and Trotskyism, are bogeymen, aren't they? For the capitalist class and for social democrat and reformist, you know, they don't like the whole notion of what Trotsky stood for. And I think, you know, you can look at this in one way, which says, well, why are they so bothered about, you know, Trotsky? Why do they use every opportunity to, you know, to sort of denigrate his name and his legacy and so on? It's at least partly, it has to be somewhere in the back of their, you know, not very big heads, is the notion that actually this is dangerous stuff. You know, that what Trotsky said appeals to people who are looking towards revolutionary change in a system that is, you know, running into the buffers and is so horrible, war, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's still such a horrible capitalist system. How do we overthrow it? Trotsky had all sorts of experience and suggestions in terms of how we do that, you know, which we in this tradition, we're part of the international socialist tradition, which can trace its lines directly back to what Trotsky wrote about how you build a party and so on and so forth. I haven't mentioned really Tony Cliff, but Tony Cliff built on Trotsky's ideas about the nature of Stalinism to sort of begin the building of what was then the International Socialists and has now become the Socialist Workers' Party. You know, this idea that Russia and the Eastern European states were actually state capitalist. Trotsky never accepted that position, by the way. Trotsky's position was that it was, you know, Russia was a degenerated workers' state, but it was still somehow a workers' state. He still held to the idea that because the means of production, the factories and so on, were held in common, if you like, by the state, that meant that there was still an element of a workers, you know, some sort of workers' state there. And we, Cliff argued, quite rightly, that it's not about the form of ownership, it's about the class relations, it's about what's going on. Is there exploitation in that society by a ruling class? And in Russia, from the late 1920s onwards, there was. Clearly, there was a new ruling class. There was exploitation of workers going on, and that made it, you know, a sort of a different form of capitalist society, what we call state capitalist. And, you know, we've stood on that line for a while. Interestingly, just to finish off, I came across a pamphlet when I was looking, which is by Trotsky's wife, who, as I say, survived him by about 20 years. And she actually came to the position that Russia was state capitalist. And she broke with the Fourth International, the Trotskyist Fourth International. She resigned from it on that basis because she said, you know, you are persisting in an error. Trotsky, she says, I'm sure Trotsky would agree with me, but you're persisting in an error, and you know you're going to go wrong, basically. And she resigned from the Fourth International at that point. And I actually didn't know that. I had no idea that was the case, but you know, that's just kind of an interesting aside. So to finish up, what's the legacy? Well, Trotsky left an incredibly rich body of historical and both historical and Marxist analysis. Andy also left a movement behind, you know, that we shouldn't underestimate. Although it was small, although it was scattered, the fact is it was an embodiment of the genuine revolutionary communist tradition that exists in the working class. Had Trotsky not done what he did through the 1920s and 30s, that whole tradition could have been snuffed out, and we would, you know, we would not have the kind of organisations that we do have now, which are, you know, intervening in the struggle and building the fight. Because, you know, our tradition has the best potential for building mass revolutionary organisations and taking on, you know, world capitalism. And it's like a big leap from where we are now to there. But, you know, come on, when the Bolsheviks, you know, were operating in 1901 or whatever, it was a bloody big leap for them to think about being a revolutionary organisation as well. And, you know, that's you know, for us it's easy. We stand on the shoulders of giants, don't we? You know, Marx, Engels, Lenin, Luxembourg and so on. Cliff, I'll finish with this. Cliff said at one time, you know, yes, we can see a long way because we stand on the shoulders of giants, on condition that you open your eyes. And I think that, you know, part of opening our eyes is understanding and, you know, appreciating Trotsky's legacy and his analysis and writings.
Thank you.